there is a lot of drawdown on the investments which have been made into OpenAI, and there may be some inflated demand generation on the AMD, on the NVIDIA side. Now, that's on one side. On the other side, if you're seeing the amount of data centers which are getting built, it actually tracks the amount of AI chips which are demanded.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of brilliant, funny, thoughtful panelists to debate, discuss, and think through the latest news in artificial intelligence. Joining us today are three incredible panelists, so a very warm welcome to Volkmar Ulig, who is VP AI Infrastructure, Ambi Ganesan, who's a partner for AI and Analytics, and then Aaron Botman, who's an IBM Fellow and Master Inventor. There's lots to talk about today. We're going to talk about a huge deal between Oracle and AMD. We're going to talk about a new evaluation out of the Department of Commerce's CAISY. We're going to talk about Reflection AI and a VC fund that apparently has fired all of its analysts. But first, Eily with the news.
Hey everyone, I'm Eily McConnon, a tech news writer for IBM Think. I'm here with a few AI headlines you might have missed this week. Visa introduced a new framework to help merchants distinguish between legitimate AI shopping assistants and malicious bots. The goal? Cutting down on fraudulent purchases by AI agents. Oracle and IBM are teaming up to release several new enterprise agents that will automate tasks such as reviewing intercompany agreements. This means more time for tasks that actually require human touch. Is the customer service agent you're speaking to a human or a bot? At Dreamforce, Salesforce's banner event, the tech giant announced is introducing AI-generated voices to its customer support agents. Sam Altman announced on X that come December, ChatGPT will share erotica with verified users over 18. What could possibly go wrong? Want to dive deeper into some of these topics? Subscribe to the Think newsletter, linked in the show notes. And now back to the episode.
Today, I actually want to open with, I think, what was one of the big stories of the week, which is that Oracle Cloud came out and made an announcement that they will be deploying 50,000 AMD chips in the second half of 2026. And this itself would be a big deal, just in terms of dollar amounts. But it follows on some two pretty interesting bits of news. One of them is OpenAI earlier in the month announcing a deal with AMD where they were going to deploy about 6 gigawatts worth of processors. And then separately, OpenAI announcing a deal with Oracle that could be a 5-year deal that's worth as much as $300 billion. And so I think, Volkmar, with you on the line, I kind of want to throw the ball to you first. It kind of feels like, you know, when we talk about this a lot at MOE, that sort of everybody's coming for NVIDIA. And there's this kind of interesting cluster emerging between OpenAI, AMD, and Oracle. I guess how threatening is this ultimately to NVIDIA? Or is this kind of just mostly like we're going to have to wait to see?
I think that the market is opening up. I think the competitors are going after NVIDIA. I think that's why Jensen has this extremely aggressive new chip every year strategy. I think the more interesting part of that announcement is also that OpenAI is investing into AMD and takes a stake in AMD. So if you look at this ecosystem right now, there is NVIDIA investing into OpenAI, then OpenAI cutting a deal with Oracle and buying a ton of NVIDIA cards, and then also investing into AMD. So I think there's a lot of money going around. And it goes in circles, which is always a question when it starts going in circles, like if it's a real economy or not, like somewhere the money needs to come from. So I think there is a lot of drawdown on the investments which have been made into OpenAI. Now, that's on one side. On the other side, if you're seeing the amount of data centers which are getting built, it actually tracks the amount of AI chips which are demanded. And so I think from an OpenAI perspective, it probably makes a lot of sense to bifurcate, to not have a single source. And AMD needs to kind of flush their first real data center chips. And so I think if you look at the overall deal, it is AMD chips with an investment of OpenAI into AMD, and then they need to house it somewhere. And Oracle is a company which is putting AI chips into data centers, you know, by the truckload. And so that's a kind of natural thing. And we saw that with the, you know, almost 40% pop in Oracle shares when they announced their multi-year deal with NVIDIA. So I think that troika is kind of a known troika. And so I'm not surprised that OpenAI is diversifying, including taking a 10% stake in AMD.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, maybe we'll turn over to you. I mean, I did see, I don't know if you all saw this like visualization of where all the money has flowed in the AI economy. And it's just, it is, to Volkmar's point, like a big circle. It's like everybody's giving money to each other. And I guess, Ambi, I'm curious about what your thoughts on, like, is that signs of a bubble? I mean, because to Volkmar's point too, like on a certain level, everybody's just sending the money back and forth. But on the other hand, it's also like these build outs are consistent with forecasted demand. So on a certain level, it's kind of like maybe not so crazy that we're sort of seeing this kind of thing happen. So curious about how you weigh this. I mean, obviously the underlying question if it's a bubble, but I think there's more interesting things to talk about there. So curious about your thoughts.
Yeah, I saw Imad, he posted some things calling this as the dot AI bubble. But if you look at, and I saw some comparison in terms of the investments that have been made as a percentage of GDP, right? If you compare to the level of investments that were made in the dot-com era versus what's happening in the dot-AI era now, right? It's still, you know, some ways to go before you even hit those limits. So I think it's still early stages. And, you know, so that's number one. I think that the amount of investment that's, yes, there are deals that's happening, but the amount of investment that's going on is still not as big a scale as you would imagine for the amount of the benefit that the economy can accrue from something like this in the future, right? So I think there is a much, much bigger, wider transformation being expected out of this. So yes, there is probably a perception that there is a bubble, but I also think like the amount of investment that's going in here is probably not commensurate to the level of unlock that can be garnered over the longer time horizon, right? So
yeah, you're almost saying like you might think these deals are crazy, but just wait, they're gonna get crazier essentially.
That's one way to put it.
Uh-huh.
Also, if you look at the internet bubble, right, so there was a massive amount of fiber optic investments for just to, you know, put wires into the ground. So people actually dug trenches. Now we are building data centers. If you look at the return on investment in the internet phase, there was, you know, investments over 20 years. Right now, if you see the since the introduction of ChatGPT, we see a 43% increase in productivity, and that's within like a year or two. So I think the internet bubble, the productivity increases came just much, much later than the productivity increase we see with AI. It's like pretty much instantaneous because the infrastructure is already present. Like distribution is there, data centers are there, people have computers, right? All that, I mean, do you remember the AOL, you know, CDs, which you had to buy and the internet happened, right? So all that infrastructure is present. So the adoption is just so much faster.
And I feel like it's almost to be expected that this would happen, right? And I think I was actually surprised that it took this long for AMD to breach this moat. You know, I would have expected this to happen sooner than later, right? Like we saw that the model moat collapsed first, right? The app layer moat was already, you know, that was already fairly open. So there's heavy competition going on in the model and the app layer. But then the infrastructure moat was the one that held really, really steady, right? And I think we're seeing cracks open in that moat now. I think it's inevitable. This is just pure capitalism at play, right? This is always expected to happen. And, you know, I was just surprised that it took this longer. And you're just going to see a lot more of this at the infrastructure level happen, you know, going forward.
Yeah, for sure. And Aaron, maybe I want to bring you in because I think on the question of the moat, right, the thing that people always bring up in the NVIDIA AMD competition is well, CUDA, right, is like that's going to be the thing that is kind of like ultimately NVIDIA's great defense here. Do we think that even that part of the moat is getting chipped away in some sense, right? Like, because I think part of it is like who's going to pour money where, but also part of it is just like kind of the optimization at this level. And so curious if you have forecasts there, how you think about that.
Well, so we followed the money so far, but I say let's follow the energy, right? Because Oracle, they're going to deploy 50,000 AMD, you know, 450s. That's a lot. That's going to be, so I did the math beforehand, but that's about, you know, 50 million kilowatt hours, right? Now, I drive a Tesla, and for that amount of power, I could drive 336 million miles per month on that single charge, right? do we really need to build all these additional infrastructure places where we could share an infrastructure? Could this energy be used elsewhere? Could power a small city, right? It costs $5 million a month just for electricity bill alone, right? So, I mean, I think rather than follow the money, let's follow the power and the energy, because that in turn is where the money is going, right? To answer the question about CUDA, right? So I think that OpenAI, right? Because they're also deploying these AMD, 450 chips, right? The hardware itself, they're very comparable, right? So we can compare like these Instinct chips from AMD to A100s to H100s, to NVIDIA, right? And there's close to parity. There are some different technologies that are done, with like the two millimeter or 2 nanometer technology that's used to create the chips. But on the flip side, what you mentioned is CUDA versus what's called ROCm, right? So CUDA, right? That's NVIDIA's proprietary parallel computing platform. That's above and beyond, years ahead of, I think, what AMD can provide with, ROCm. Right, which is AMD's GPU computing, right? It's now it is open source. The adoption is smaller and it's less mature than a CUDA, but on the other side, I am impressed that AMD is working a lot with, for example, OpenAI, right, to make it better, right? But again, going back to NVIDIA, right, they have other libraries like CUDNN, right, where it can help you performance tuning. Right, deep learning algorithms, which are the fundamental building blocks of Gen AI, right? So I do think AMD has some catch up to do in that area, even though they've caught up on the hardware side.
So I want to jump in here. So right now, if you look at the CUDA wall, effectively all vendors have decided to build compatibility layers. And so you get the equivalent of a CUDA implementation from AMD, and Intel is on the same path. So we are, like, the world is standardizing against CUDA. And that requires a re-implementation of, where NVIDIA had 10, 15 years to actually build up that wall. And then on the flip side, on top of it, you have OpenAI really aggressively driving Triton, which is a programming abstraction against GPUs, which is effectively hiding the fact that there's CUDA under the covers. And so you have effectively attacks from both sides, which will kind of come out somewhere in the middle, where, OpenAI, they started Triton to become GPU independent, and everybody else says, oh, well, I need to support the ecosystem, let me just be CUDA compliant. And ROCm, if you look at their compute layer, AMD cards have been in high performance computing forever, right? If you look at the Becquerel machines, they are all based on AMD GPUs. And so those libraries are extremely hardened. ATI, which is AMD now, right? The whole series of AMD chips comes out of the ATI fold. And ATI and NVIDIA were always going head to head, and both of them had OpenGL implementations and OpenCL implementations. And then effectively, at some point, AMD said, okay, we are going a different route. We are making a new stack. We're making everything open source, and we call it ROCm. And AMD went all the way and said, okay, we even released the details of the chip, the internals. So you get the assembly language, everything, right? So that's AMD's strategy. NVIDIA said, no, we do everything closed source, and we actually have a hardware abstraction layer where the card under the covers can be changed, and we are compiling an intermediate binary to that underlying card. And so they can actually hide some card peculiarities in that compile layer. So very different strategies. But in the end, if you go not even 30,000 feet, but if you go like maybe 3,000 feet, an AMD card and an NVIDIA card is effectively the same fundamental architecture, compute architecture, right? And so I don't think that it's so hard because, of that, to see that that compatibility layer being built.
Yeah, you're almost saying the kind of like even though it has been much talked about as a massive moat, it may actually be in practice like much more shallow than we think.
Yeah. We tested AMD cards over a year ago in CUDA compatibility mode, and we can run large language models. So you don't support everything. You don't have the fluid dynamics and all that other stuff, which NVIDIA, and if you look at it in Jensen's last keynote, he's like, hey, we have these like 15 industries we are working in and we can do everything, right? But then on the flip side, if you look where the highest demand is, it's run VLM, right? Run an inferencing engine. And so if 90% is run an inferencing engine and 10% is all the other stuff, I think that, the mode for the other stuff is not where we have, you know, trillions of dollars spent in industrial capacity.
Yeah, almost Jensen has these kind of interesting incentives to like try to like push the other stuff, right? If those grow really quickly, then he's got more of a moat than kind of the core use case, which is pretty interesting.
And I think in both of what Aaron and Volkmar said, I feel like, okay, now we're seeing, yes, we thought always infrastructure was the bottleneck, but I think, you know, now we may be reaching a spot as this grows between AMD versus NVIDIA and the moat starts cracking. Energy may start becoming the bottleneck, right?
So that's just
that's going to be an interesting.
It's just infrastructure.
It's all infrastructure, like, yes. To Volkmar.
Like, I mean, go on. Like, it's yes. Now we are going one down. Now Schneider is the bottleneck. HBM was the bottleneck.
Yeah. Well, I think this will be kind of the interesting like vertical integration that you potentially see happening, right? Mm-hmm. Which is okay. Well, we've got OpenAI taking stakes in the chip companies now, right? It feels like it's just a matter of time before this blob starts taking stakes in like energy, right? And then you kind of just like go down. Like you imagine, like actually, ultimately, this will be sort of vertically integrated in a certain sense.
I think the interesting part here is that how fast the semiconductor industry was actually able to adjust. If you think about it, right? I mean, there's a lot of pricing flexibility in microprocessors, and how slow all the other industries adjust. Like to try to buy a transformer. We are going into a world where the actual physical infrastructure, which you know does not go through these extreme growth phases, suddenly is forced to, you know, I need like 100x the capacity of power.
Right, like tomorrow.
Tomorrow, exactly.
Yeah, right.
So I think, but that will also lead to if I cannot buy data centers, I will have a much higher replacement cycle because I can get a card in much faster, which is twice as powerful than getting twice the power in, right? And so we will see probably for the next couple of years, very, very aggressive silicon replacement simply because the rest of the infrastructure cannot sustain this. It's cheaper to swap out the NVIDIA card than to build another power plant.
That's right. Yeah. I think that will be one of the funny legacies of this is obviously like building power is good for lots of different things. But like essentially like the accelerant of AI is going to basically like force a bunch of build out that will have all these really interesting collateral effects outside of AI. And it's just kind of this weird, like the tail has wagged the dog in a certain sense in the era that we're in.
Yeah, I do like where the AMD chip is going. It's more cost efficient, right? Because it has a lower price per teraflop, right? And so, you know, with whenever you scale it up, you know, if you do the extreme testing of 50,000, you know, GPUs, they're going to be saving millions per month, which translates more than likely, you know, lower energy costs, right? And then, you know, we at IBM, we have this True North chip, right? That's very, very low energy requirements, right? Can run on a mobile device, right? And it runs out of, neural correlates, right? So I think this, you know, competition between AMD and NVIDIA is good, right? Right? That it increases innovation, such that we can solve some of these, you know, big problems that are here and are going to be still coming.
All right, I'm going to move us on to our next topic, though this is an amazing discussion, kind of getting into the guts of this story. Next bit I wanted to kind of cover was this interesting report that came out of the Center for AI Standards and Innovation, which is a unit within the Department of Commerce that is kind of like the government's eval shop for AI models. And this is sort of one of the first kind of real sort of public reports that they have done, where they basically said, look, we, the government, the Department of Commerce, took a look at DeepSeek and we evaluated DeepSeek against 19 benchmarks. And their conclusion is, well, in comparison to US models, DeepSeek lags in performance, it lags in cost, it lags in security, and it also lags in adoption. And so in some ways, it was kind of like the don't worry about DeepSeek. Was the headline in some ways. And I guess, I mean, maybe I'll throw it to you. Thoughts on this? Like, I guess when DeepSeek first hit, I think we had a lot of discussion on MoE that, like, oh man, this is going to force everybody in the industry to have to adopt. How do you compete with free? You know, huge danger. And I guess the kind of question for you is, looking at this analysis, maybe DeepSeek is not that big of a threat to American AI businesses as we thought. Is that the right way of thinking about it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of dimensions to this, right? So I think we've always stressed that, hey, when you're building models, yes, you know, you should have the right level of guardrails. You should have the right level of security, especially in enterprise settings, right? I'll talk about, you know, when I'm talking to my clients and we always talk about models, then, you know, in an enterprise setting, those things become really, really paramount. So yeah, I think it's interesting to see that, you know, amongst the American models versus the Chinese models, right? You know, I think it becomes obvious outside of all political connotations, you know, the market always chooses for, okay, for my enterprise requirements, I'm going to go with models that meet the appropriate security guardrails, the appropriate requirements, and so on, right? The other angle that I saw from all of this is, you know, there is, I think this opened up, so DeepSeek, yes, you know, it opened up a lot of mindshare to open models and open source models, right? Embedded in this report was also a statistics, which, you know, we may not have captured, which is there's like an increase in like 1,000% in download of, you know, DeepSeek models. So, you know, and the consumer behavior also drives enterprise behavior because consumers ultimately sit in enterprises as well. So from that perspective, I see that the mindshare opening up to just open, you know, open source, open weight models. So, you know, not just working with proprietary models. So it's an interesting dynamic between, yes, I want models that are reliable, trustworthy, safe, but I also want a wide variety of models, choice of models, and I want to be able to have an open element to it. I can go and inspect it and so on, right? You know, DeepSeek, by nature of having open weights, is what enabled us to go and, you know, pressure test and stress test all of this and then figure out, you know, how it's performing, where the security implications are, and so on and so forth. The third element in all of this is, I feel like, you know, yes, there is a bunch of metrics that we're talking about, but at the end of the day, you know, outside of the security guardrails and all of that, right? From a performance perspective, like, this is still falling into the trap of benchmark maxing, right? At the end of the day, yes, you know, yes, you do need some baseline benchmarks, but at the end of the day, when you are doing this in an enterprise setting or for whatever use case, right, like, you have to still work with how does it measure for you, right? So there has to be that dimension. So yes, I think that the safety element, the trustworthy element, absolutely, right? I think that gives us a good connotation in terms of, you know, what should be used versus what should not be used from an enterprise setting. But there are these other angles that I think we should look at in terms of whether it's truly performant or not, whether it's truly performant at the cost that it's supposed to perform or not as well, right?
Yeah. Ambi, are you kind of saying, I mean, because everybody has this desperate need, they want to know who's ahead, who's winning. But I guess you're kind of saying that, like, maybe this analysis doesn't reveal ultimately a whole lot about who is ahead in some sense, because I think you think ultimately, like, the benchmarks are a little bit artificial as a way of evaluating this. Is that the right way of kind of thinking about what you just said? Yeah.
So yes, on the safety angle, right? I think that's a clear dimension on, yes, you know, like, if you're getting hijacked and if you're falling through some of the security elements, then yes, I think that's a clear one. But from a true performance perspective and cost optimization perspective, I think we can't just take it at face value and say, yes, oh, you know, this, you know, DeepSeek is performing or not performing, right? You really have to take a model like that and then see whether it's working for your use case or not.
Because all these benchmarks are open, right? You can actually train, and everybody who trains a model is constantly evaluating against these benchmarks, and that's how you are stopping your training, right? Once you hit certain levels of the benchmark or you don't improve. So I think we don't really have black box testing. And the thing is, in the market, you know, when you come out with a new model, every new model, you better beat your last model and you better beat, you know, the top of the market. So I think it's interesting to see an independent kind of closed source, you know, because if you look at the the benchmarks, NIST ran, it's like cyber coding skills, right? It's like some of these benchmarks are open, but others, they're just like, you know, proprietary. And so suddenly you see things where the model wasn't optimized for pop out, right? And so I think what you're seeing is that probably DeepSeek overfit on the public common benchmarks and really try to optimize for that. But from a, you know, making a splash, that totally makes sense. So I think that it shows a little bit more of the depth of the US companies of, you know, building more generic models, because the technology hasn't been necessarily like, you know, single focused on, hey, we need to be on that leaderboard. But, you know, they made it on the leaderboard because there's deep tech behind it. Now, does that mean that, you know, the team with new benchmarks cannot evaluate their models? Absolutely. I mean, this is how you're building a model. If you're trying to build a generic reasoning model, you know, you're making very, very large benchmarks, and then you're trying to figure out where your model has weaknesses. And the methodology of finding that's the IP, right? The IP of the company when you're in this training is to know, oh, here my model is weak and here it's strong. And those internal benchmarks, they will not release. I'm sure that the DeepSeek people are like fully aware of whatever came out in the NIST report. They just will not go to market with that.
Yeah, and Aaron, I think that's actually Volkmar's kind of pointing us to the direction that I want to sort of push you in, which is the dynamics of this are very interesting. Particularly if you believe that like some of the most valuable evaluations, benchmarks you can do are all going to be black box. They're all going to be secret. and I guess the kind of question is like, if you in the future, you feel like kind of the eval ecosystem is going to increasingly be kind of like more and more opaque, right? Because it's kind of the only way of sort of preserving some kind of genuine signal that you get from these evals. Because I agree with Volkmar. I think one thing I took from this KC report was, well, you know, DeepSeek kind of trained to the test. And so maybe it was actually less impressive now that we look at it a little bit more closely. But it suggests a lot of things about how we should do evals.
Yeah, I mean, you know, on a surface level, this is a story about contradictions, right? Because DeepSeek V2 was released in June 2024, right? And they made these big claims. You know, they said, hey, you know, DeepSeek R1 is 96% cheaper than O1, right? It performs better, if not equal, on other benchmarks, you know, benchmarks such as the Math 500 test, the measuring massive multi-language understanding. But if you wrap all that together, you know, and then you look at what NIST did, you know, you ask yourself, how did this happen? You know, how did NIST all of a sudden come up with something different? And I think about this of like driving a car, right? So a benchmark, what is it? Well, a benchmark on a car is like top speed going 0 to 60 miles per hour. What's the braking distance? Now, on the other hand, what is a standard evaluation? Well, a standard would be the crash safety, the emissions, the cybersecurity for autonomous systems. And so what's happened is, I believe that NIST focus on standards evaluations, right? Whereas, you know, you're looking at DeepSeek focus on benchmarks, right? Because whenever you start peeling it away, you know, you can see that, the NIST organization, they're looking at benchmarks that don't pass adversarial prompts, you know, things that don't have political neutrality. They're looking at, those other types of areas, which some of the benchmarks do have overlap in the Venn diagram and the intersection, right? But they were measured in very different ways. And I think the way that, you know, NIST did it is very important, right? Because this rolls into the operational cost, right? The risk of using, you know, foreign type models, right? And so that story of contradictions, right, I think just goes into how do you measure this and how best you want to tell the story. You know, the saying goes, I can have stats, you know, tell me what I want to hear, right, all the time, right? And I think that's what's also happened here. You know, I can cherry pick different stats and measure it in different ways, but ultimately, I think this is great news, you know, for the AI community, right, as well as giving us more choice and really beginning to elucidate, you know, what's happening underneath the cover and give us a more independent measure.
Yeah, on the cost angle, I want to jump in. You know, I think one of the other pieces that came in that report was, you know, they advertise about the, you know, the per token cost. Like, we always think about, what's the consumption of tokens cost, right? Like, I was talking to my clients earlier this week, and again, you know, thinking about models, that's always front and center of mind. Oh, what's my per token consumption cost if I'm going to build use cases, right? But I think the interesting metric here, the interesting comparative analysis here was that, well, if you're trying to use the same model or the two models for the same set of tasks, right, then it's not just about your per token consumption cost. It's about the per task cost, right? Even though your unit cost may be lower, your actual effective unit, which is the task completion cost, is actually way higher, right? So I think there is some of those nuances that need to be had as well when we think about the economics of all of this as well.
I'm going to bring us on, and I think we'll actually bring a lot of the themes into the next story. So it kind of shifts us away from the world of sort of government evaluations of foreign open source models to, I think, a related business story. So a startup by the name of Reflection AI just announced a raise that they had done. It's $2 billion at an $8 billion valuation, which in this day and age seems kind of oddly small in a certain sense. And it's run by former DeepMind alumni. What I wanted to do by flagging the story, though, was that like their big pitch on this round, they had started as like, we're going to do agents and a bunch of other kind of AI buzzwords. Their new pitch is, we are going to be the leading frontier AI open source company for the United States. And I guess maybe, you know, Volkmar, I'll kick it over to you. I'm sort of really interested in like, won't the leading open source player in frontier AI simply be the existing frontier AI companies? Like, I'm really curious about if there's room for this kind of pure open source upstart in the sort of the US market right now, and how you size that up.
Yeah, so I mean, when I read the article, it kind of said we are going to be open weights, but not open training. So it's not that they are releasing the training sets. And so from my perspective, I'm not 100% sure where the differentiation will come. Now, if you, they will have to fight against Meta. And the big question, and look, I mean, there are other companies which make frontier models. IBM is making frontier models. Everything is in the open. We release where our training sets come from. You know, we are extremely open about like anything which goes into the model, including indemnification. So now they are coming and saying, well, we give you another open source model. So they better find an angle where that model, like just being open source, I think is insufficient. And three years ago, you know, this would have made a huge, yeah, wow. Yeah, but now it's, I think a lot of the large players are already in the market. So they have to find an angle, you know, where like, if you look at an Anthropic, I mean, they really found, you know, the developer community. And I think they may come with a similar angle of saying, okay, you know, we find a specific market where we have a model which is better than everybody else, and we make it open source, and you can fine tune it to whatever you have. And if they, you know, and then the question, next question is like, you know, OpenAI was also called Open and AI, and now they are the most closed company on the planet. So we will see how that will play out. And I think, you know, the more the merrier. If you have more choices, it brings pressure. But I think also, like, as you just mentioned, you know, the investment size is much smaller, relatively speaking, you know. So we may be at the tail end of the ability to create, you know, foundation model companies. So it may just be, you know, a tail end company. It's a really strong team. They have an experience, and they have proven, you know, a proven track record. So I'm sure you can find funding. And if you look at the players, NVIDIA's in it, a bunch of others, you know,
you know, yes, that circular money thing again.
Yeah, exactly. So it may just be they take the you know, the $1 billion they get from NVIDIA, another $1 billion, and give it back to NVIDIA.
Yeah, back to NVIDIA.
But I think that overall, I think we are probably, from an investment perspective, at the tail end of yet another large language, you know, foundation model company. I think that's kind of like an indicator, because it has kind of slowed down. And I think there are enough choices on the market, and every VC put their chips on the table, and they cannot, you know, they cannot invest into competing companies. So I think we all probably, except for NVIDIA, because, you know, they get money from everybody.
Because of NVIDIA.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we are, I think, probably at the tail end, which is good to see, right? So that means the money now can go somewhere else. So I think we are, from an investment perspective, if you solely look from a VC perspective, I think we are are moving on from, you know, do we need another model company to what are the applications, right? And that's the, I think, you know, we got the fiber optics in the ground. So that's done. That's called NVIDIA and AMD, and we're building data centers. So now we got, you know, we got TCP/IP and we got that. That's the foundation model guys. And now the next question is who's going to be the Google and the Amazon? And so that's really, from my perspective, that's where I'm looking, is like, you know, what are the applications which are going to like really shift industries around? And right now we are still at the plumbing layer, right? We are looking at electricity, we are looking at GPUs, et cetera. Those are all the ingredients to actually build the businesses which are going to be transformational. But you need that capacity and that infrastructure in place.
Aaron, do you buy Volkmar's assessment? I guess it's not necessarily a pessimistic view, but sort of the idea that like the kind of era is already moving on, and that I guess in some sense, like open source is no longer kind of as cool or in the very least as distinctive as it used to be. Curious about how you size up the prospects of being able to create like a genuine independent open source competitor in the space.
I mean, it looks as a, you know, Reflection AI, it definitely has all the ingredients to be a successful player, but success is not guaranteed here. You know, I always think in terms like Winston Churchill, you know, says that, you know, Americans will always do the right thing as long as they've exhausted all other possibilities. And Reflection AI, they don't have time to exhaust all possibilities here, right? To be successful, right? And so they're going to need to be very, very focused, you know, to make a difference, you know, and this tail end, which yes, I agree that this is a tail end, you know, market where it's becoming very saturated quickly. You know, but I think some of the strengths are, you know, the track record, right, of the founding members. You know, I mean, they're known, came from DeepMind, right, AlphaGo, and so on. The funding and valuation seems to be somewhat decent, but the investor roster looks good. You know, I mean, they have NVIDIA, Sequoia, talent recruitment, market position, but they have a very ambitious roadmap, and it's all about speculation. They haven't released a single model yet, right? I mean, what are they actually going to do, right? And so that gives you execution risk, right? Frontier LLMs, you know, they're extremely resource, but also expertise intensive, right? So both of those combined, you know, is hard, right? There's a lot of competition. We've already mentioned open limitations. Only the weights are going to be open, right? It's not like how we provide not just open weights, but we clearly say what is in our data pile, right, that we're using. They only have a team of 60 people, but I mean, you know, so the pros and cons on that, you know, pendulum there goes up and down. But I think, you know, we'll see if this is going to work out, and they're going to need to fail quick if they're going to be successful.
Ambi, I want to zoom out a little bit. We've been talking very much about the kind of U.S. market, right? Like, can a company like Reflection go toe-to-toe with Meta, right? Or even, I don't know, OpenAI's open source development over time? On the backdrop of this Casey report, it's kind of interesting to think a little bit about, right? Which is, okay, well, let's just think about the international competition for open and think a little bit about like the peer competitor for Reflection AI is not maybe necessarily Meta. It's actually maybe like a smaller lab like DeepSeek. And so kind of like a lot of the natural competitors seem to be like these kind of Chinese open source upstarts. Curious about how you kind of size up that competition, right? Like maybe not like the small guys versus the big guys, but small guys against small guys is kind of the interesting comparison I want to go into.
I think it's a good branding exercise they got going there, right? Which is frontier, open model, etc. So I think it's a good branding and USP. But whether you put it in the frame of the US market or the international market with China, right? At the end of the day, so... Yeah, I sort of agree with what Volkmar and Aaron mentioned. I sort of don't agree that it's saturated in the sense that if you're thinking about generic LLMs, then yeah, you know, you're sort of reaching the tail end. But again, you know, it's all speculative at this point. We don't know what they're releasing, what their details are. So maybe they will pivot into other modalities, right? So go into like world models, who knows, right? So maybe that happens, maybe that doesn't. And even in the, you know, the pure text-based large language models, the space where I don't see saturation is verticalization, right? So if you're thinking about generic LLMs, yes, we're seeing some sort of saturation going if you think about LLMs applied in the context of coding agents. And, you know, there, I think you're starting to see, I wouldn't say full saturation, but, you know, fairly good maturity. But you extrapolate it to, say, enterprise domains and verticalization in the enterprise context, there it's still fairly, you know, a wide swath that's still, you know, open to be conquered there. So it really depends on exactly what they're trying to build and where they're going to go, right? So it's all pure speculation, you know, whether you put it in the context of, you know, the Chinese models or the frontier models in the US. At the end of the day, everyone's playing for the global market, right? And no one's going to be restricted to, hey, I'm going to go play only in this market, right? So at the end of the day, you just have to look at the market as a whole market.
So I mean, what you just said, I think is an interesting one. Like, you know, verticalization, if you look at companies, right, they have proprietary data sets. What I haven't seen yet is the whole, like, global foundry-like, you know, business model where you say, okay, I'm a manufacturer of your company's model. I'm giving you the core technologies. I give you, you know, help how to actually build it, and you build your own model, you know, and we already did all the pre-training. So I think this is where these open source or semi-open source companies could go, where there are new opportunities. Because right now we you know, take this model or go home, and the fine-tuning is kind of, you know, it doesn't really work. So I think that whole industry will go through a couple of iterations until, you know, companies can actually at a reasonable cost build their own proprietary models. And I don't think that the industry isn't even created yet to do that. And so I think there's still
it's an open spot there. Yeah,
that would be super interesting. You end up with kind of like the Foxconn models.
Correct, exactly.
It's basically like we just have this huge compute cluster. Everybody can be a frontier AI company now.
Well,
that play is just one I haven't really heard about.
I mean, it's not only the hardware, right? But it's also like, okay, and I give you 90% of the training set, and I give you training methodology, right? And I'm just the assembler, and then, you know, you pay me like $5 million, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right, I'm going to move us to a final kind of fun story. It's a little bit of a throwaway, but I feel like the joke I have is like every few months there's a headline, which is, can you believe that they automated and fired all these people from this particular X job? And that story has finally apparently come to VC. So there's a story out of Business Insider about this VC collective called Davidov's Venture Collective, or DVC. Relatively small funds, given the numbers that we've been talking about today, $75 million. And what they have kind of done in terms of their promotion for their VC fund is to say, we have fired all the analysts and replaced them with agents. And this is maybe actually like somewhat more of an interesting story than it might look at first glance, because really the model that they're doing is they're saying, look, we're going to have a lot of LPs who are going to be various people at various companies. And what we want to do is use them to help us source deals for the VC fund. But a lot of the sourcing, diligence, analytics, analyst work, essentially, is going to be done by AI. And so I think maybe, Aaron, I'll kick it over to you. I was sort of interested in this idea that basically, like, what AI is going to do is not necessarily it certainly replaces the jobs, but what it's kind of doing is, like, shifting the labor, right? So typically, like, LPs would never be like the ones sourcing. But I guess the idea is with technology, you might be able to lower the costs enough that they become the ones that source. It's almost like a fancy version of now how you have to like check out all the groceries by yourself, right? In line, just on the finance side. And so anyways, I was curious about, Aaron, what you thought about this business model. Do you think it's viable? Do you think it's mostly marketing? How do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, just to bring this story back down to earth, right? You know, whenever we say DVC has eliminated all of their analysts, it was five people. Right. And they use AI agents to assist, right, with deal sourcing, portfolio monitoring, due diligence, and so on. What I think should have happened, right, is that instead of doing job replacement, right, because AI is not a story of mass job replacement or even small job replacement, it's about job transformation, right, that rather than firing anybody, right, I think we should become AI translators. You know, that our value as humans and as workers just becomes amplified by these types of tools. You know, so we have new roles that are emerging: ethics engineers, you know, synthetic data engineers, behavior engineers, auditors, right? Those types. But I mean, we could even see maybe we're becoming agent orchestrators, moderators, or even AI psychologists. You know, but I mean, that said, you know, I think that the replacement of people is a misnomer. I think it's the transformation you know, of people and doing that. Yeah, and there's also this sort of relativistic piece of how each person interprets AI. You know, some people might think, oh, these AI agents are sentient, you know, where they can perceive, feel, and experience, or they're sapient. They can think, they have deep reasoning, you know, but because I build a lot of these systems, I think neither of those, right? But somebody who's just a, you know, just the easy, you know, a user who comes in, you know, does a flavor of the month search and they see the results. Wow, it must be sentient and or sapient, right? But all of that, right, I think is important so that everybody, you know, has a fundamental level of understanding of AI and can become a translator. So I would challenge DVC to maybe change the narrative a bit, right? And let's talk a bit about how people are going to be amplified rather than replacing.
Yeah. I mean, that transformation narrative, I think, is an interesting one. Ambi, doesn't all this beg the question of why you even have a VC fund in the end? Like, you have a bunch of LPs that are now going to do all the work of sourcing and diligencing companies, but now with agents, I suppose. But it sort of begs the question of, like, what this business even is once you've done that.
Yeah. You talked about self-checkouts, right? I don't know about you guys. When I go to my local Costco, right, I go to the self-checkout lane and I still have my cashier still help me check it out. But then we just do it in a much faster pace, right? To Aaron's point, like, it's not a complete replacement, but you know, the coordination is what makes it faster and more effective. So, yeah, I think there is a little bit of a spin going on in this DVC article, this news here. So, yeah, you know, once you separate the wheat from the chaff, yes, I think that's a very pertinent question to be asked, right? Like, okay, what exactly is the, you know, core analysis or really, you know, hypothesis testing and stress testing that you're really doing that warrants, you know, deep expertise versus just, you know, some rudimentary analysis, right? So I think there is it also exposes a little bit of, like, okay, what exactly is the in-depth stuff that's going on, right? But I think the flip side to that is when you think about the VC funds, it's not just pure the analysis, right? There's also the relationship angles to it. So, you know, I think you have to look at it in the angle of both the hard and the soft elements. So, you know, I think you're trying to chip away a little bit on the hard elements and make them a little easier, but the core soft elements still exist, right? So you're just leveraging them as much as possible.
Lokmar, I'll give you the last word here.
Yeah.
If you have any thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I was an inventor for a year and a half, so I've seen the belly of the beast side. So the first thing is the fund is very small, right? It's $75 million. That's almost nothing. So the way usually these funds work is you take a bunch of high net worth individuals and they throw, you know, everybody throws in $1 million, $2 million, $5 million, like on the top. And then you build a fund that runs over 10 years and then you're trying to return the money. If you are on such small scale, everything you do, you invest in people. There's no, because like you are effectively pre-product, you're pre-anything, right? So because, I mean, how much money can they put in? $500,000, $1 million. So everything is effectively relationships. And so the biggest problem of the VC world is deal flow. And so the natural thing what you do is you try to find people you incentivize to bring you deal flow, in particular if you are not a tier A. Everybody wants a tier A's. Nobody wants to be invested by a tier B. So you need to say, hey, you know, I have something to offer. And so what they do is they say, okay, I take all these people who chip in money and they are my limited partners and I give them an you know, exceptional return, but for doing that you need to give me access to your network. And so the LPs are probably high net worth individuals who are in the tech industry. And so suddenly you get signal and you get early signal because you have someone who is your spokesperson. That's how you get deal flow in. Now if you look at analysis, it's like, okay, if you are putting $500,000 in, the analysis is, okay, can you write code? And, you know, are you a good human being? And that's pretty much it. And then is the idea anywhere reasonable? If you look at deep analysis, so you have a labor pool analysis problem. So are people good or bad? How do you find them? How do you help these companies off the ground? But it is much more like doing market intelligence. You know, is there a market? Is there no market? What's the product? And then which people should you hire? That analysis is something which, you know, you can really AI-ify, because the other analysis is usually when you're a later stage, is much deeper financial analysis, you know. So you're looking at, you know, what's your revenue, what's your forecast, what's your cost, etc. But that happens in the, you know, post-product and already in market. So because that's such an early stage, actually doing, you know, analysis is not that much of an analysis, but a crap shot. And so it's really like, okay, you know, having a relationship to people.
Well, that's a great note to end on. That's all the time that we have for today. And thanks to Ambi, Aaron, and Volkmar for joining us. We'll hopefully have you on again very soon. And thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.